This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
7:35 right now. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng and Tan Chung Han. Now, in the global business headlines this morning, we have Nissan, as the chief executive, Carlos Ghosn, is leaving his role at Nissan Motors. Now, he was instrumental in rescuing the company from near collapse, and he had led the company for the past two decades. So now Carlos is going to be taking a broader role to oversee Nissan's alliances with Renault and Mitsubishi Motors. But can the company survive without the man who is essentially saved them from collapse?
Yeah, I think that's the main question that has to be addressed right now by the Nissan Group as well as by Nissan investors. Ghosn himself wants to focus on Renault. There was a boardroom battle in 2015, which was sparked by the French economy minister Emmanuel Macron, who's now actually running for presidency. So you can expect some degree of hostility to corporate maneuvers within Nissan if this guy takes over as president. A lot of firefighting needs to be done. A lot of diplomacy needs to be carried out between Renault and the government. And I also think that the competitive landscape is changing and is hotting up in Europe because Peugeot turned around in Europe and they're looking for more acquisitions over there, and that might provide some competition to Renault.
And one of the targets for that competition for Renault is the European operations of GM that we spoke about, right? So again, when you have got these expansionary measures that are being undertaken by these competitors, Nissan, I wonder if this leadership change is really happening at a good time, right? But that aside, from the European front, if I can segue back to the Malaysian context, now this is also something that Tan Chong Motors will have to look at closely, right? Because, they have been struggling, to say the least. They have reported three consecutive quarters of net losses last year. Granted, they have yet to report on their fourth quarter earnings, but we are in the midst of earnings season, so I'm sure those numbers are coming out soon. So given the turmoils that we're seeing at the local space, I wonder how much that global leadership changeover will affect Tan Chong Motors.
I think the Malaysian performance would belie the kind of advances and progress Nissan has made since Ghosn took over 20 years ago. Nissan is right now on the global auto map. I mean, they produce about 10 million cars a year, and this puts them really in the league of General Motors, of the biggest car companies in the world. So 10 million compared to total industry volume in Malaysia of about 700,000 here. So I think Nissan really has got to think globally. The other thing that they're really thinking about is their relationship with Mercedes-Benz, because they share a kind of same platform for the luxury SUV market. And now they are in a position of reviewing that relationship, because now I think Mercedes and Nissan are in competition over there.
Okay, well, there you go. So auto industry side, let's take a look at the property market, specifically Singapore's property market. The billionaire chairman of City Developments, Kwek Leng Beng, believes the worst is not over yet for Singapore's property market, because especially after the government has implemented those measures to cool the real estate market there. So the government's curbs have actually pushed down home prices a third for 2016. And Kwek was saying to Bloomberg TV that he doesn't believe the worst is over, although he believes the worst has indeed slowed down.
Yeah, there's Kwek Leng Beng is actually the cousin of another Malaysian tycoon, Kwek Leng Chan. They sold about 1.2 billion Sing dollars worth of property last year, about 1,017 homes in Singapore in 2016. That results in an average selling price of 1.2 million Sing dollars per home. And I guess City Dev is the kind of company that focuses on luxury homes in Singapore.
Yeah, and when you consider that house prices, right, declined in Singapore for the 13th straight quarter in the last 3 months of the year, it's really got to make the developers down there really sit up and take notice, right? And also, going back to some recent developments here, when Singapore passed their budget 2017 this week, one of the key takeaways, at least from analysts, is that there weren't measures to alleviate those cooling measures in the property sector. They had income tax cuts, They had their cash payment that's equivalent of the brim down there for to alleviate the concerns of rising water prices and GST, etc. But what was noticeably lacking was the maintenance or the keeping those cooling measures in place. So, you know, this really ties in with what Kuei is saying.
Well, the Singapore government has already come out to say that they are reluctant to ease any of these measures. They
That's
are
right.
worried that the property market will overheat again. So they want to keep the cap at borrowers' debt repayments at 60% of borrowers' income. They want to maintain the higher stamp duties as well. So again, they believe, unlike, say, you know, they believe that they want to keep these measures going. They also want to keep the market from they still want to cool the market. And I wonder whether property owners in Singapore feel the same way, because if you have your luxury property come down about 35% to 50%, that is a significant amount.
That's what I noticed. I think they do, because Kwek Ling Bing, or City Dev, is the second company that has come out to say that these stringent measures would remain in place for a while. Capital Land a few days ago was the other one. And the sentiment that you get is that these major property developers are, unlike their Malaysian counterparts, the property developers here, the Singapore developers are not really whining about government policies. They're taking it in their stride, right? And so they want to, I guess, work in line with a mandatory government policy in Singapore to make property prices more affordable over there. But you will notice from the portfolio of, for example, Capital Land, which is a major flagship company of Singapore's sovereign wealth fund. I think it's Temasek or GIC. I'm not sure. I forget which one it is. But it is a major Singaporean company. And this company only has 4% of its portfolio in Singapore. The rest are outside
4%.
Of Singapore. So you can see the kind of diversification strategy that a major property flagship company like Capital Land, I mean, Capital Land is like the Sime Darby or like the SP Satir of Singapore, right? And they have this major embarkation of foreign diversification. All their portfolio is elsewhere, outside of Singapore.
I mean, yeah, we're seeing that with SP Satir, even EcoWorld as well, you know, especially when we consider the EcoWorld of the prospective IPO of the EcoWorld International, right? But then also taking it to the broader context there, you know, Julian, you're right. I mean, okay, perhaps Singaporean developers are not whining. Maybe because they're Singaporeans, so they're trained not to whine, right? I don't
about
know.
Government policy. Yeah.
Are you sure? I think Singaporeans are so kiasu, right? They whine all the time.
Well, maybe, but you know, like when there's one small protest, war, new Singaporeans are protesting, war, never happened
but
before.
But not the corporate leaders. No, I'm just being facetious there. I love my Singaporean friends.
Sure. Backtrack, man. But then real quick, you know, looking at the global trend, though, like you are seeing these cooling measures, not just in Singapore, but in Australia as well. We have covered that. Even here in Malaysia as well, they have tweaked the various measures, you know, say RPGT and also the minimum threshold before foreign investors can buy properties here. You know, so it is a global trend. And also, I guess it's something that, you know, not just Singaporean developers, but pretty much many other developers around the world have to deal with.
I think a distinction also has to be made between the Singaporean and Malaysian market, where in Singapore, there are higher levels of international trading, perhaps some speculation, and the income levels there are also very high, although what we feel is unaffordable property, you know, five times median salary in Malaysia, that 5 years of salary to buy a home is classified as extremely unaffordable in Malaysia, but there's also five times in Singapore, but they're just saying, nah, that's
affordable,
pretty affordable.
Yeah. It's a different world just across the causeway, shall we say. Okay, guys, about 10 years ago, 2017, Warren Buffett made a $1 million bet that hedge funds would not outperform index funds over the next 10 years. And now down the road, it looks like the billionaire investor was right. So his chosen index fund, the Vanguard 500 index fund, has climbed 66% since the start of the bet until the end of 2015. If you compare that with the basket of hedge funds selected by asset manager Protochea Partners, they had a 22% gain. So far cry indeed.
So Protégé would probably have to donate that $1 million. They would lose the bet and they would have to donate that to charity. The deadline is this year, 2017. It's a 10-year bet. And a lot of why Protégé lost the bet is due to cost. And back in 2007, 10 years ago, actually the chief of Protégé expressed a lot of hubris and a lot of pride in saying that while it is true they agree with Warren Buffett that costs are a major factor affecting returns and impacting returns, he's had a lot of confidence that the hedge funds would be able to overcome those costs by clever management of the
right.
funds.
So now, although this was a 66% gain from the start of the bet until end of 2015, it's going to take a ginormous market crash for Warren Buffett to lose this bet, right?
Especially when you see the trajectory that US equities are on. For example, Dow Jones, just use that as a barometer. That's what indexes are. They have reached 10 consecutive days of record high at close, right? With that kind of, granted, 10 years ago when Buffett made this call, I'm sure he had that magic eight ball. But once again, it shows, Buffett, very much in the news right now, especially when you consider, say, that Unilever Kraft deal, which didn't really work out. He was playing hardball with them, but then now that's apparently, according to media reports, prompting Unilever to then rethink, what they're doing. Did they really reject it for the right causes? They're launching a strategic review. So again, hats off to Buffett here.
Yeah, also surprisingly, Warren Buffett is passing all his investments after he dies to ETFs, to index managed fund. And this is really antithesis to his whole life's work, where he's an active manager and still supporting the idea that passive management is the way to go after he dies, right? So there is something very telling about what he does. And perhaps we can get more insights into what he's thinking when his letter, his news, very much awaited newsletter comes out tomorrow.
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to seeing Berkshire Hathaway's fourth quarter results as well as it'll come out after market closes later today. So let's take a look at the local business scene after this. We're in the thick of earnings season at the moment, so we'll discuss the results of Axiata, Maybank and Genting Malaysia. That's coming up shortly on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.